13-point separate the pole man Danny Pedrosa and the championship leader Jorge Lorenzo.
Problem with the starting lights. They're going to have to go around again. You just saw the amber lights came on, and there's obviously been some kind of problem with them. And luckily, nothing happened.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 337 for Wednesday the 19th of September, although for me it's actually the early hours of Thursday the 20th of September. My name is Martin Darlington. I am in the north of the Wales, and with me is Jim Race across in the California.
I'm doing well, before you ask, sir. And yes, we can certainly tell by the grogginess of your voice. I'm sure that'll pick up as the show moves along. But Martin just dragged himself out of bed. I always chuckle whenever we do the morning shows with you, because I swear to God, I talked to you. I don't know if Jules ever rolled that one bit in when I called you at, like, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the morning, when you made the misfortunate mistake of having Skype on your phone and you were active.
Yes. I was like, what's going on?
Do I have to fly? What is it? we've got a great show for you guys today. Our request to continue to write in certainly netted quite a bit of correspondence, so we're totally cool about that. No interviews this week, but we did talk to a lot of people behind the scenes, so we'll have some feedback from there. I do want to give a awesome shout out to one of our donators, a donator this last week, Doug Edmonston. You guys have heard that name quite a few times. Thank you very much, Doug. I did note that I believe he donates per paragraph. So that was very cool. But I think what we should do, Martin, since we did talk about listener feedback, is just dive into it. Are you ready to talk about any yet, or would you like me to do it?
Do you want to run with Michael's first one? Because that was a conversation you and Jules were having.
I will. And let me there we go.
A quick bit of in-show errata. It's Doug Edmiston. There's no N.
There's no N in there?
No, it's Doug Edmiston.
Oh, well, he makes enough mistakes anyway. All right. Well known as Demented, right?
Yes, on Twitter. Absolutely.
Yes. All right, so let me dive into what Michael talked about. And this is, you guys remember, obviously, last week that we talked a hell of a lot about CRTs. And I'm sure that banter is going to be going on, continuing as the season rolls through. But Michael Leon wrote in, he says, the subject line was, what would an alien do on World Superbike versus what would an Earthling do on a CRT? And it kind of jogs back to the T-shirt that we gave away at Indy. He says, I enjoyed your banner regarding the comparison between CRT and World Superbike. After reading the description as an argument, I was expecting the gloves to come out, but it was all handled in a very civil manner. Well, that was just the parts we didn't cut out. I agree the only way to declare one faster than the other is to have an actual race. In the end, that's why we have races, isn't it? However, if we want to speculate, I'm sure that the CRTs would be faster. Just look at the specs. They both use production-based engines. From what I understand, the CRT rule would have less limitation on modifications, so they would have an advantage in the engine department. At the very least, they would be equal power-wise. Now, I'm going to pause here because just a thought for you, Michael, and the rest of you folks out there that might agree with him. I'm not disagreeing, mind you, but something to think about. The World Superbikes have years of development, whereas the CRTs are still trying to get their feet under them. So, I don't know. It's an interesting thought, and who knows? But again, that's, as Michael says, you know, that's why we have races. Anyway, to carry on. The CRTs can do whatever they wish with the chassis, where the World Superbikes are limited to the stock chassis and have to live with any design flaws until a new model is released. And again, yes and no, because there is a lot of tweaks they can make to them. But carrying on, the CRTs are free to fix any chassis issues as the season progresses through redesigns, so the CRTs would have an advantage in the chassis department. Both are running open ECUs, so they're equal in the electrical department. Sorry. Therefore, we can safely speculate, and he put that in caps, that given an equal rider, tires, track conditions, team competence, and budget, that a CRT bike would definitely be faster. Well, there's a bunch of ifs in there. And yeah. you know me, Martin, I'm not a big if kind of guy. It's food for thought. Yeah, you know, who knows? Like I said, until you get them on the same track at the same time, like he says, with the same tires and team competence and all that, I don't know. My point last week was that it's incredibly difficult to do comparisons. You know, if it's not on the same day, if it's not on the same tires, it's not in the same weather and conditions, even if they look close, then it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have some thoughts about that if your eyes are open yet.
Yeah, I just think that there are so many different variations on any given day, and as Mike says, the difference between the same track on a different weekend, it's almost impossible to assess. And the other thing is, I mean, the World Tour bikes, I remember James Whittam taking us across, I think it was James Toseland's championship winning one in 07. And when he went through all the differences from a stock bike, it pretty much is the name, and they try and keep the look similar. So a Fireblade you buy will look similar on the, you know, as Johnny Race has got that snub nose fairing, same as the one you buy for the road. But I mean, apart from that, under the skin, virtually everything's changed. So I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily a particularly important conversation, to be honest.
It's true, because they
well, remember when Moto 2 started, and the few people were up in arms saying, oh, World Supersport's faster. Well, that didn't last long. And at the end of the day, who cares? They're not racing against each other.
Well, and even so, a lot of people were saying, well, they're not as quick as the 250s. And how quickly was that eclipsed?
Yeah, exactly. Like you say, CRT is a very early concept. World Superbike's been around for, decades.
Yeah. What else was I thinking about? There was another comparison that I was thinking about. Yeah, I was trying to find an apples to apples one. And I had something that came to mind, and now it's just gone, and that's not unusual. So carrying on, I believe you should give him his paragraph's worth. Mr. Douglas Edmiston.
Yep, and Doug is talking about the news that Ducati next year will be having a junior team, that it basically will be a lower tier factory team. And then they came out and said, well, when we say lower tier, they'll all have exactly the same bikes. And there's been speculation as to whether all four bikes will remain the same spec. And Doug says, personally, I think Ducati will keep all four bikes on the grid exactly the same spec. Maybe not to the liking of or at the will of Ducati themselves, but look how Audi goes racing. Different teams, same cars. Doesn't matter which team wins, because in the end they can say, we won, whether it's the factory team or customer satellite teams. Development would also hopefully speed up, at least in theory, with five or six riders on the same bikes, that being Hayden Dovey, Ben Spies, Crazy Joe, Ian Oney, and the test riders. On the signings to Ducati, Doug feels that Crazy Joe will definitely seems like he has the lack of caution towards his health to make the bike work. Maybe not as well as, but similar to how Stoner made it work. He's already basically crashing in every corner anyway, so it won't be a new concept to him, which I thought was an interesting take. But it is interesting that they've got four very different style riders there. You've got Dovey is super smooth and should have gone to Yamaha years ago because it suits him. But he may prove to be incredibly adaptable, or Ducati may prove to be very adaptable. Nicky Hayden's quite happy with the back stepping out, but he's not necessarily wild. Joe Iannone or Andrea Iannone is wild, reasonably. And Ben just has a unique style, which involves lots of elbows. But it will be fascinating to see, whether they try and do a Yamaha and make a bike that anyone can ride, which I suspect is their ambition, if they're deliberately hiring people with such different styles.
That's an interesting thought. The other one is, take four disparate darts and see which one sticks.
yeah, that's true. Spread your bets.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that even if we see, and I don't doubt that they're going to try and put four equal bikes out for the beginning of the season. And maybe that will carry on as the season goes on. I think a lot of it is going to come down to, taking a step back to what Michael was talking about in the prior bit we were talking about is the team competence and the budget too for those teams. Yeah. Which frankly, those two things go quite hand in hand. Budget experience, that's going to be really key. Are you going to have the kind of people? And one of the things that we don't know yet, Martin, is who the personnel are going to be. We haven't heard anything really to this point as to, for example, if Tom Houseworth and Woody are going to be going with Ben, or if they're going to have new personnel on the Ducati side. And it's not unusual for Ducati to want to have their handpicked people, but at the same time, you don't want to necessarily interfere with what has worked in the past for a rider.
No, but a few weeks ago, there was a rumor on Twitter, and I can't remember which of the journos it was, but it was someone of the stature of Matt Burt or David Emmett, saying there was a rumor that Casey's old Ducati team, who'd gone with him to Honda, may well be going back to Ducati, because Marc Marquez is going to bring his, wants to bring his people up with him. Danny's already established. And that would be interesting.
I've actually started ignoring rumors on Twitter, because there's so many of them that just don't come true.
Yeah, it's it's so much fun.
Well, they may be fun, but it's starting to make everybody that talks about them sound like the Italian Spanish press. And frankly, that's kind of disheartening, because it's like, how many directions do you want to lead people in?
But also, there have been journos who have had riders, established MotoGP, been around the paddock a lot of years, riders say, Ben Spies is going to Gresini. You can publish that because that's a fact. And then a few days later, he signs for Pramac Ducati. So there's some pretty well-established facts that actually turn out to be, they were just rumors too. So yeah, it's very difficult to sort out the wheat from the chaff.
It seems like it's Twitter seems to be about 90% chaff.
Yeah. Doug also mentioned more about the CRT, but I think we've probably done that, the CRT versus World Superbike thing, to death. And I can't see any time soon, despite Toby Moody's wishes, them racing against each other. So I'm going to suggest we move on from the CRT discussion.
I believe we can do so. In fact, there's a bit here again. In fact, there was a good conversation that was had between you and Nick Codling today in email. where you very, very kindly included us on this side of the pond. You can tackle that one as well.
Well, Nick had sent an email in just talking about the race and how gutted he was at what happened to Danny, because he was looking forward to it coming down to the wire. And he also wanted to clarify his comment from last week when you read out Nick's email saying about motorcycle, the MotoGP bike weighing less than a packet of cigarettes. He said he was kind of using a bit of a extreme analogy, and he wasn't quite sure if the humor was picked up. So we had a little bit of back.
Of course it is.
Yes, yes. I think he's aware of that now. But he did say, what of the future? Rossi back on Yamaha. We have to assume he'll be competitive. Realistically, the title must come down to Jorge, Danny and VR next year, if and whether Danny is able to take the fight to both of them. He says he hopes so, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Still got this year to finish off. And then mentioned, Rossi coming second. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves because we're going to cover the race. But just saying that there does seem to have been a leap in development, and I think we'll probably address that. But had he seen that sort of that leap 12 months ago, who knows where we'd be now? What a pity. And again, I think we'll address that a little bit later on.
I actually don't mind talking about it now. I mean, it was obviously a big step. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's nobody that listens to this show that doesn't know what the results are by now.
No, that's a fair point. And yeah. Rossi did very quickly say, No, I've got no regrets about the decision I made for next year. But then he went on to say, but we do have to choose far too early in the season. He said we shouldn't even be thinking about it till after Bernau, the same way as it was 10 years ago. You know, and silly season has got, I mean, we've seen it in the last two or three years. It gets earlier and earlier and earlier. And then it goes on and on and on.
Yeah. I mean, it started the first major puzzle piece to fall into play was what, in June with Jorge re-signing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that kind of rocked the world. But I mean, there was a whole bunch of talk even prior to that. Now, a lot of that, if you think about it, was prefaced on the fact that we knew that everybody knew that Rossi wasn't happening. The Ducati development hadn't been moving forward. But a lot of, if you think back to the speculation back then, Martin, was that he was going to quit. And obviously that hasn't happened. But you're right. I mean, it does keep, I'm waiting for, you know, somebody to re-sign after they re-sign or to sign with somebody else after they re-sign at the beginning of the season.
Yeah. And this year was a bit thrown out of kilter by Casey's announcement he was retiring, which happened, was it France, Portugal? I mean, it was dead early.
Yeah.
And having denied it the race before vehemently, then came out and went, yeah, I'm off.
Yeah. You know, these things come in cycles. I'm trying to remember back. This is one of those times where I need Dr. Rain's handy. When can you remember? That would have been a great question for him. When can you remember the silly season ever being this silly? And I bet he could come up with an answer that would actually find one that had been this completely off the hook.
Well, 2 years ago, Rossi to Ducati, there were still people denying it right up to the day it was announced.
Yeah, but that didn't happen until Laguna, or no, to Indy.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. I see what you mean. It being that this extended.
Yeah. All right. So, yes, it was definitely cool to see Rossi in second. And again, we will talk about that a bit. And Nick also said, you know, hard to imagine when men might be possible, but, you know, who knows? Wouldn't that be cool? And I think it would be. You never know. But I mean, if Rossi can win a race, there's no reason that Danny can't win a few. And I know that you're going to put on your fanboy hat, even though you claim it won't be, and talk about Jorge a bit later in the show.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you will. I know that you've been clamoring to get on here. You've been very busy. Martin, you know, one of the reasons we haven't been able to have him on so much is because, well, you know, he's a pilot. And so these early morning shows, I guess we are his coffee, although I'm sure he's got a cup of there.
I certainly have.
Yeah. And well done. And he's got responsibilities. You know, Jules and I just have to go to work and deal with code. Martin has to go deal with people that fall over on the highway. So what else did we have? Paul Myers wrote in.
I like this.
Yeah. He says, so given that Danny has come up short, he says, see what I did there? Two questions for you. One, and this is one's on everybody's mind. One is, will Honda issue team orders when Casey comes back? And two, if so, will he adhere to them? And I think, my speculation, you can put your two cents in, Martin. I'm pretty sure Casey's probably going to come back at PI.
He's saying Japan, apparently.
No, he said PI, and Autosport reprinted an article today. That was taken from an Australian TV show that he said, yeah, I'll come back at PI, but he kind of said, I think I'll really be back at Japan. But trust me, the guy's going to come back at PI.
Right.
I said that when he was still getting...
PI is the last of the three flyaways, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that's one where he's, you know, would be six in a row. And
and I think if Honda want to issue team orders, they might as well save their breath.
Well, yeah, they can do it. But I would say that were he in the chance to win that race, he would probably win it. I don't know. I'm trying to put myself in his place, which is a really tall order, no pun intended, for me.
Yeah.
How do you want to go out? You know, how do you want to finish off your two-wheel career?
I don't think he'll be planning to come back, so I don't think he'll care what teams think. He won't be thinking about future hiring, so I think he'll want to go out as the absolutely dominant home rider in Australia.
Yeah. I don't think I would disagree with you.
We'll have had three more races between now and then, so the picture will be much clearer. It may be that if it's really tight, yes, Honda might try and put a lot of pressure on him. I don't know what they'd offer him. I don't think he's motivated by money. But it might be, if it's, you know, still 38 points or thereabouts with two races to go, I don't think they're going to bother about team orders. Unless they say to him, look, could you take out Lorenzo, please?
I like that. That would be a very interesting thought.
Yeah.
That would, I'm sure, go over great with Mr. Mike Webb and the rest of the people that actually run the series. he says, carries on, surely Honda would be crazy not to suggest it. That's what a teammate is for in this kind of situation. As a race, we're little to lose by saying bollocks to that. And one of the races being his home race, I suspect Casey would ignore it. However, although he... this is great. Although he can be a whining, moaning little bugger, he is also a good guy and might just do as requested. Thoughts? Well, you just heard them.
Yeah.
Yeah. William Bitch Irwin. Oh, bitch. Did I just say that?
William Bitch Irwin.
Oh, that's funny. Well, I went from whining, moaning little bugger to bitch. Bill Irwin wrote in with some coxisms. And it's funny because he knows how much of a fan of Charlie Coff you are.
Yes.
You know, Martin, I'm telling you, I sat next to the guy and he wasn't so bad. Granted, he was a little bit drunk and
I'm not commenting on him as a human being. I'm commenting on him as a commentator.
It'd be interesting if you listened to us and actually gave us some commentary back. But I'm going to let you read these because I just want to hear you do it. If you can do it.
So these are the William Butch Irwin ones. One of them,
not bitch.
The first one was referring to Danny Pedrosa. He doesn't look HP. But to be fair, I'd heard Toby Moody use the line, he doesn't look HP, earlier in the weekend. So Charlie Cox is a plagiarist as well as a boss-eyed swiveler.
Okay, pause. You need to explain HP.
Happy.
Oh, HP. Okay.
It doesn't look HP, happy.
That did not translate to this side of the pond.
I believe that's what it is.
We had to have some translations on this.
And then there was an interesting discussion because I saw this on Twitter that Jorge Lorenzo will be, and a lot of people thought he said smoking like a Cheshire cat. And of course he'd said smirking like a Cheshire cat, i.e. smiling. So that was another one.
Let me pause really quick here to explain to, because you know, half of the people listening to this thing are Americans. They may have never seen the BBC broadcast. We're talking about a gentleman named Charlie Cox, who is an anchor along with Matt and Ozzie Farnay on the BBC broadcast and Steve Parrish, right? Yeah. Steve Parrish. Did I catch all of them, I hope?
Well, the main race commentators is Charlie Cox, and then Steve Parrish is the color guy.
And then Matt Roberts and Ozzie Farnay on the grid. Okay. Yeah. So if you've not seen it, this may all just be going, you may be going, what the fuck are they talking about? The gentleman has a tendency to use some euphemisms, ways to express himself that, while not so bothersome to some folks, really jam in other Brits' craws.
My biggest point with him, he comes up with these phrases and we have no idea what they mean, like, you know, oh, he's having a nightmare in a bubble car.
Well, yeah.
It's used normally at least once a race. And that shot the fox, which we, having researched it, I discovered
it's actually,
means that's the end of the game, the sport's over, which is probably quite an aristocratic phrase. So I don't know what an Australian's doing using it. But he's an ex touring car driver, not particularly successful one, I don't think. And what gets me about him, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Even after 4 years, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Steve Parrish constantly has to correct him.
I think that's the thing that like really bugs people. He does have a tendency to kind of blow some of the race calls. But then on top of it, he's got these little sayings that he does and people are like, okay, well, it's even worse. You know, Martin, I'm pretty sure that I actually asked him, and I don't remember his answer, what Nightmare in a Bubble Car was. And I think I asked him, I remembered enough to go back and explain it to my table. The problem was the people who were at my table, including Jules, happened to have been at the bar for the same period that I was, and nobody remembered.
Yeah.
So apparently there was an explanation, which has since faded from memory, which might be a good thing. Anyway, carry on. Let me go on with these.
Number three.
This is like the David Letterman top 10 countdown. This has had most of the high points kicked out of it this race. I have to let you do these because I don't have the accent.
That was just the fact that the race was sort of, or the title element of the race was finished on the first lap. Next one, he said, one thing that's not uncertain is Barbera had a brain problem. And I think we can all agree with that. And then he said, for Valentino Rossi fans, that's anyone who's ever watched a motorcycle race. I think there's plenty of people who are admirers, but they're not, wouldn't call themselves fans. And that was the ones that Butch Irwin picked out. And in the post-race summary, he managed to squeeze in Shot the Fox, although I don't think anyone had a nightmare in a bubble car this week. But one thing that really wound me up, different pronunciations, but they kept, both he and Stu Paris kept referring to Lucio Cecchinello as Cecchinello. And I think that's a bit disrespectful, not knowing how, I mean, they've been around the paddock, certainly Steve Parish, for decades. He was in it. They should understand Italian pronunciation, but it's like, you know, if someone's calling Jules Cisek, you know, you'd correct them. You'd say, I know that's pronounced Cisek.
I used to call him Cisek.
It is Cisek, isn't it?
Well, no, I like cheese sack.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Yes.
Actually, I think the entire pronunciation thing is kind of overblown, but I think there's an ongoing controversy here as well in the States about how to pronounce Jorge's name. And people get really up in arms about it. I think it's like, please just come really close. I mean, I've heard some that were just horrible. I watched a World Superbike race the other day where I'm trying to remember who, it was to Nürburgring, where it was Neil Hodgson and who?
Steve Day.
Yeah, Steve Day. And Steve Day was making a mockery of rider names. And I just said, okay, well, then that's fine.
Yeah, I was slightly uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, we know who they are. And so I said, well, that's not anything for me to get upset about. So I'm just going to let it go.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't, because I mean, technically we should say Jorge Lorenzo rather than Lorenzo. And I sometimes use the anglicized Z. So, yeah,
I swap back and forth. And I mean, Toby Moody pronounced a region in Spain this weekend with a instead of a Z. And I was like, it caught me off guard. And I was like, okay, that's fine. I really don't care. I've got more important things to think about. Carrying on, I think we should go.
Tony Ionu from Thump Photo did put a little funny thing in. Merriam-Webster Dictionary has listed a new verb, barbered or barbering, to be punted when you least expect it, which will become clear when we talk about the race, if anyone doesn't know what happened. If you don't, what are you doing listening to this?
I actually kind of take some issue with what happened in that crash because I think a lot of people do. We'll get there. In fact, talking about it like this actually means that we'll be able to speed through the rest of the race. Other stuff going on. 2013, we've got some testing dates.
Yeah, but we haven't yet got even an outline calendar.
No, and I think there's some reasons for that. Some that we were thinking about talking about this week, which is some of the pending dates right now. Still kind of wondering about what's going to be going on here in the States as well as in Spain.
Should we wait till we have at least a projected calendar?
Oh, absolutely. And so we won't talk about that, but we can talk about the testing dates, which is fine because those are set in stone. February 5th, 6th, and 7th. I mean, and this is stuff that we always have, but I mean, at least give you guys an idea as how far you're going to have to wait once winter comes around, or depending upon if you're down under how long your summer is going to be. February 5th through 7th at Sepang. February 26th through 28th back at Sepang. I wonder if they leave the bikes there.
You'd imagine, wouldn't you?
Well, you never know, because you run a test with a brand new bike and you can take it all the way back home. Well, I mean, I guess it's not that far if you're in Malaysia. If you're in Europe, right? Yeah. It could be quite a bit further. And then finally, March 15th through 16th in Jerez. That's for MotoGP. Obviously, the testing schedule for Moto2 and Moto3 is going to be quite a bit different, and they spend more time on the continent. That would be your continent.
Yeah.
John Hart talked a bit about a quick article on Superbike Planet regarding the 2013 calendars. We still think we're looking at three U.S. rounds. And Jules and I had heard about this quite a bit, but we were kind of sworn to secrecy. But the good possibility of World Superbike coming back to Laguna Seca next year. It's not quite public.
Although it is now.
simply because Dean can't keep his mouth shut. But it's certainly a possibility that that may happen. Word is through some folks that may be a done deal. The two people that I've heard say it, they're pretty well in the know. What else? We know that Abraham and the Cardinal AB team is going to switch to the Aprilia Art, you know, setup next year, away from Ducati. Wasn't quite happy with that this year. Certainly they weren't very pleased, Martin, with what happened with two failing clutch components at the beginning of this last weekend's race.
Someone slightly cruelly commented on Twitter that Carol Abraham will be able to get the same results, but with a good excuse for why he's so far back on CRT bike.
That being said, you know, it's interesting. This might put somebody like Krell in a bit of a catbird seat, because we know the Aprilia Art is quite well capable of running at the front of the CRTs, right?
Yeah.
And as we see the rule changes coming down with potentially a spec ECU and rev limits and the bike starting to close down, early experience on that platform might give him a leg up. And there's a lot of people that were kind of bitching after this weekend. And there was a very, very straightforward denial of responsibility, if you will, from that team that I respected greatly, to be honest, saying, hey, what happened with Danny was not our fault. And I agree 100%. And that's my 10 word synopsis of it. And I agree. And so and we'll talk a lot more about what happened at the beginning of that race, because it did quite change the weekend. Anyway, carrying on, the final remaining non-CRT seat for next year, and that would be at Gresini, which we still don't know, Martin, right? If they're going to be on factory kit or not. Appears to be between Alvaro Bautista, and he's done his chances no harm by getting his first podium in MotoGP. Johnny Rey, who will have has done his chances no harm by a good steady performance, made more impressive by the lack of dry track time, which was impressive, granted. And, you know, if he can run well at Aragon, he's already had some track time, that would definitely be a good thing to do, which will be interesting because the weather between there and Portimao, where they're running this weekend, so World Superbike's coming up this weekend at Portimao, has a tendency to be fairly common, and the tracks actually have a couple of things in common as well.
Yeah, the only thing about Portimao is it's right on the coast, so it picks up that Atlantic ability to dump rain instantly, similar to Phillip Island, so...
But if you say that,
I can't think of a wet race we've had
there. I know, I was just going to say. Yeah. I've seen plenty of wet testing there. And to be honest, usually I would look and see what the weather conditions were predicted, and I haven't yet. Oh, no, okay, I take it back. I do remember seeing a tweet. Oh, Christ, I'm going back to tweets for factual information. From Eugene Laverty that posted a...
A photo of AccuWeather or something, a screen grab that showed that Saturday and Sunday was going to be raining at Portimao. Now, that was on Monday, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so they're guessing.
Yeah, so they're guessing.
More than 3 days, it's an educated guess.
Yeah. But there's a potential of some weather this weekend. But regardless, Aragon, I think, is a track that would favor Johnny. And so that sounds like it might be good. Scott Redding may also be in the mix.
I've made a comment here that I don't know why, but I personally think Bautista is in pole position for it because I can't really see what he's done wrong. Johnny Ray, I feel, is ahead of Scott Redding. And I don't know, it's a combination of Suzuka. And for years, we've been told, particularly by the British motorcycle racing press, that Johnny Ray is a favoured son of HRC. They think very highly of him. They like the fact he's always been Honda. I think even in his motocross days, he was Honda. And quite possibly, you know, holding that flag up against KTM's. And there is this story that San Carlo, the main sponsor of Gresini, have launched in the UK and therefore yep. want a British rider. So, you know, that might be really unfortunate for Alvaro Bautista, who hasn't done a lot wrong. And, he's had a crash which took the title leader out. But, you know, that can happen to anyone. Hector, hey. And I mean, particularly his first MotoGP podium at the home race, from the team's point of view, that couldn't have gone better.
No, and certainly it was a sentimental podium as well. I believe you're getting a little bit weepy there, weren't you, Martin?
I was getting becoming quite emotional.
Yes. And also in the running, but we'll have to see, would be Scott Redding. And somebody that, you know, definitely wants to get out of Moto 2. Nothing's going to happen as far as a weight rule in Moto 2. I think they're pleased with the formula as it is, and they don't want to mess it up. And frankly, I'm quite happy with that too, because I think the weight rule is kind of, in a bike like a 600, I really don't think they're appropriate. It's just a matter of fitting on the bike and being able to fit underneath it. But Scott doesn't do that. So he needs to find a machine that will fit him from a point of view that is physical. Right.
Yeah.
Yep. I was tempted to talk about, carrying on about, you know, our sort of, I love it. We call these pre-show bits when we're like halfway through the show, don't we?
Yeah.
I was thinking about addressing some of the stuff that's going on with Circuit of the Americas and Kevin Schwantz.
I kind of lose the will to live when it gets to these things. It sounds to me like it's not going to affect anything to do with MotoGP going there. It's just about who gets credit for what.
Yeah, it may or may not, but I texted with Jules just before you and I had a conversation. I think we're going to save that until we know more.
Or until we're really bored and got nothing else to talk about.
No, I think it's worth talking about because it actually does kind of reach into the heart of the sport and the business of the sport. And I think that's certainly worthy of us talking about. We talk about the sport of the sport quite often. But I think the business and politics of the sport is just as important for us to talk about because it's something that doesn't get covered probably as objectionably as we would have the capability of doing. But that being said,
objectionably or objectively.
I'm sorry. Yes.
That was a Freudian slip.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Kind of like, sorry, bitch. We will, it's something we will cover in a future show, but not right now because, we do have a lot to talk about. Do want to mention, many thanks to the folks at Dorna. Hi, Laya. Hi, Mater, for squeezing him in. Len Pidia, who has been on the show, did a show with you, Martin, what, about a month and a half ago?
Yeah. And wasn't he good?
Yeah. Is going to be covering Aragon for us in 2 weeks. So, not 2 weeks, a week and a half, the weekend after this one. So that will be very cool. We weren't sure if we were going to have anybody there to do it. We're going to have to do it remotely. We will have a gentleman on the ground. So I'm working hard to try and make arrangements. And it looks like we were going to have maybe Gonks and Phil Hall
if all goes well, at Phillip Island for us. So,
and for this week, happy birthday to Gonzalo, who, get this, turned 24 this week.
Yeah, screw him.
24.
Martin, my birthday's coming up couple of weeks from now. You don't want to know how old I'm going to be.
Yeah, I do, because that's going to make me feel better, whereas Gonzalo just made me feel really old.
Yeah, we'll talk about that off the air, I believe.
Okie doke.
All right. Martin, why don't we kind of zip through? We'll talk maybe. Let's figure out how to do this. Let's try not to get stuck anywhere. I always like letting you kind of talk about qualifying and such because you seem to enjoy it. And I will put in my two pence where I feel it's suited.
Super stuff. Moto 3. Well, basically, Misano was a very mixed weather weekend. Thankfully, it was dry on the Sunday, but we saw, as we've seen many times this year, the sessions were wet, dry, wet, dry, wet, dry. For MotoGP, none of the top riders went out at all on Friday, which would have hurt Johnny Ray because he didn't get any dry track time. Moto 3 went out, and the qualifying, we had Cortesi, Fanati and Antonelli on row 1. Kensel on Folger row 2, Tanucci, Kai Ruthin and Oliveira on row 3, and the noticeably absent name comes up on row 4 with Sissis, Maverick Vinales and Louis Rossi. Whatever happened to Louis Rossi, who started the season so promisingly?
But I do have to say, every time I hear people say that Sandro Cordesi is German, I just like, man, he can't be German. That sounds like an Italian name or a Spanish name.
I think he might be of Swiss. If he's Bavarian, which I think he is, and I do stand to be corrected, then it's quite likely that the family come from the Swiss border area, where obviously you have a mix of Italians, French, Germans, and Romanish. So, yeah, it does sound. But I mean, he's German by language and culture, that of his personal upbringing, whatever his DNA might be.
Certainly. It's who is the kart driver that was Scottish? He's married to a Hollywood star with an Italian name. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, we had Joe Calzaghe, who's an Italian derived boxer, but is very Welsh. Yeah. So
crazy. But this was the first time we had in quite some time we had two Italians on the front row of Moto 3.
Yeah, and the only serious challenger to, in fact, it might now be the only mathematical challenger to Cortesi's title race was Vinales. And his wet weather riding is just not improving. Nope. Now, I have said that Lorenzo didn't win a wet race at all throughout 125 and 250. I think it was Le Mans in 2008, or it might have been even 2009, where he first won a wet race and went, oh my God, that's the first time I've ever done that. So it didn't hurt him, but then we are having an increasing number, it feels, more wet races in the last year or two than we previously would have done. And climate changes, eco-mentalists can jump about that one. But, I don't know. I mean, maybe he needs to go to Kenny Roberts Ranch, because Lorenzo went at least twice and was beaten up by the Roberts clan, but came away obviously having learned some stuff. He needs to do something, because his challenge is basically dribbling. We got into the race.
Well, before we do that, I do want to run through Jules' notes, because Jules has a bunch of stuff he wants to interject on here. Because
warm up.
Yeah, in our mad scramble to try and figure out who the frick was going to do this show, and I ended up being the guy that had to do it with you, Martin. I'm just joking. Jules wrote a but.
There's a warning about time zones in there, isn't there?
Yeah. that was a big cock up, as they say. Jules talks about warm up, but he also says an FP2 Fanati crash because his right knee slider came off and got caught up in a rear wheel. That was caught spectacularly in slow motion and is available on MotoGP.com for subscription holders. Link in show notes, which means we have to put it in. Hopefully, Jules put that in. So during warm-up, the camera's in his garage and grabs a ball peen hammer from the toolbox and makes a show of banging his sliders into place. I love this guy. Jules has become a massive Moto 3 fan this year. He also says a lot of followers, but this is where we actually get into yours. So talk about the race itself, and then we'll talk about your comments.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we the race fired off, and it was the standard, you know, peloton at the front of Moto3.
We had a lot of fallers.
Were a lot of fallers. I mean, Danny Webb, first corner, I think, took out two other people, was very philosophical about it. He said, I had a terrible qualifying, but knew we could do better. So I was being rash. He said, look, everyone's allowed to be a bad boy once. This was mine. He'd gone and apologized to the other guys. Racing incident, no big deal. In fact, he was quite jolly about it. And then we had Nicky Ayo went out fairly early, and then we had a bunch right towards the end, Jack Miller, Jasper Uwema, Louis Rossi, who we mentioned earlier, but none really from the lead group. And we had quite a lot of dramatic leader changes where it wasn't just someone getting mugged for first place and dropping to second. It's like three or four would get past, because if one overtakes you, in Moto3, there seems to be three or four bikes almost attached to the back wheel of that leading bike. So yeah, you can't get back in. You can't slot back in behind him. And there were some real changes. And Fanati, having led for quite a while, fell back and looked as if he was going for fifth or sixth. And then Cortese managed to get out just enough of a gap on the last lap. But Alex Rins and Luis Salom, Vinales was chasing Cortese. They, not brutally, but they quite aggressively got past Vinales. As we came on to the very out the very last corner, Vinales went on to the AstroTurf, but Rins, he didn't push him there. I mean, Rins made the pass. It wasn't a double movement as we saw Johann Zarco do to Nico Tirol last year. It wasn't one that was anyone, I think, looked at with a, ooh, that was a bit borderline. But Rins sat up and looked
and
back.
And looked back, I know.
At Vinales to see, I don't know if he was in anger, to see if he was okay. But in doing so, Rins ruined his aerodynamicity.
and Fanati just said.
And Fanati came from fifth and popped in for third place and got a podium. And didn't he just look happy?
It would be very interesting if anybody out there has the time or the energy or the wherewithal, or if you're just absolutely completely bonkers, to count up the number of changes that we had, let's say just in the top three, throughout that race. I'd be very interested in whatever numeric value you come up with, because that was, to me, one of the best parts of the race. Was it was a complete card shuffle every lap.
Yeah.
Although to be fair, Fanati led that thing for a long time, but everything that was going on behind him was a complete, you know, just mess. It's like, okay, you know, I rewatched it again tonight, Martin, before I talked to you, and I went out to have a smoke. At one point, I think we were maybe 2/3 of the way through, and I knew where I could go out safely without missing anything. And I was listening to it like it was radio. And I'm like, I can't keep up with this. I've got no idea. It was Moody and Ryder. And I'm like, I can't even imagine. You know, it's kind of silly.
Go on.
Yeah, no, you go ahead.
Jules' note, he said, apparently the lack of a Spanish winner makes Martin, who should change his name to Martin, think this was just a pretty good race. Well, first of all, I don't have national allegiances other than, of course, being British, but I'd like to think when it comes to races, I'm pretty objective. I don't have a national or a manufacturer allegiance.
You do have a bit of allegiance to a particular rider, Martin.
Oh, Lorenzo, yeah, but he could have been Venezuelan, and I'd still think the same about him.
Jules, you'll have to make the judgment on that one.
Anyway, and the thing is, when I said it was a pretty good race, the bar has been set so high so quickly by Moto3. It was an excellent race, but in Moto3 terms, you know, it was just what we've come to expect. And we have had a couple of slightly more sedate races recently. So it was good to see it return to form. But Jules says it was an incredible, incredible race, which showed everyone's strengths. Vinales looked like he had an impossible task, and Summer made it to the front, which was brilliant riding. Salom did his usual brave, insane on the break stuff. Fanati was incredible up front, but showed his inexperience when he allowed himself to get surprised by Cortese being sat up in the corner. And Jules makes the very valid point that that surprise is what allowed the others to also get by.
Right.
And I did like this point he made, and I think it might have been an email or a tweet I exchanged with someone basically saying the same thing, that Cortese can turn on the fury at will, but more importantly, can turn it off and just ride smart. This guy is going places. Brilliant finish. And it was. And the finish was Cortese, Salom, Fanati were on the podium. Rins, Vinales, and Folger following up, and so on and so forth down. But what it means for the championship is we now have a 46-point lead by Sandro Cortese, nearly two full race wins.
Yeah. I believe the term is almost unassailable.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just said, I think that's it, chaps. We've got another German world champion, which is nice for Germany and Sandro Cortese. And he's had some brilliant little comments he's made this year. Do you remember when people said, did you squeeze Vinales a bit? He said, I left him enough room to come second, which I thought was an absolute classic. Very mature head. And whoever it was I was exchanging this email with, I did say, I don't want to get into national stereotypes, but he does remind me of Bradl, that ability to, he can be aggressive when it's appropriate, but he can sit. I remember when I spoke to Stefan at Silverstone, and I said, you know, you don't seem to have a particular aggression, but you do seem to be able to think. And he said, well, I try and think more than just about the corner I'm in, you know, but then sometimes he has to make that snap decision. And I think that's an incredibly rare and valuable asset. So Cortese running away with it. And Vinales under threat from Luis Salom, who's only 10 points behind him.
Yeah.
Fanati well established in fourth, probably safe from back or front. But yeah, it looks like Vinales is going to fail to grab that prize.
That being said, there's no doubt that his star is still rising, regardless of whatever.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he was the Marquez of Moto 3 for this year. He was so tipped, and he's
perhaps overly so.
Yeah. 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 Speaking of Marquez in Moto 2, we had also a wet warm ups, and did they have dry QP? Do you know what? I can't remember. Yeah.
They did have a dry QP.
We did. And we had Marquez, Espargaro, and Scott Redding on the front row. Takaki Nagagami, Andrea Iannone, and Tom Luthi on the second row. Rabat, Williot, and Callio row three. So on and so forth downwards. The race was brilliant. Absolutely loved it. However, it was a bit dramatic at the front because on the third lap, of the start, Gino Reyes' bike exploded in spectacular manner. And Jules has put in, Gino is the Ben Spies of Moto 2 this year. He certainly has had a load of difficulty. Bollocks. Yeah. So after three, well, it was counted after four laps. It was red flagged, and we had the finishing order became the grid for the restart. So it's Iannone.
And I should note, because at that point, Jules and I were watching it live, and it was, I don't know, 3:30 in the morning or something like that. And we were both kind of laughing because they have those classic witches brooms, the sort of wicker brooms that they use. We're like, oh, my God, they seem so old school. But apparently they wipe up cement dust quite well.
And they did a very good and quick job of cleaning it.
Well done to the marshals.
Yeah. So we had Iannone, Marquez, and Espargaro at the front row because Iannone had started like a bullet. Nakagami, Redding, Rabat, Luthi, Simon, Callio, and so on and so forth backwards. So we had race part two, slightly shortened, and it was fantastic. We had we did lose a few riders. We'd lost Gino Reyes. He was unable to restart. one bike rule and all that. Stephen Odendaal, who South African had gone out right at the start as well. But other than that, we lost Takahashi and Corsi together. Takahashi looked very, very unhappy. Mm-hmm. But on the race itself, Marquez sort of kept his he kept his powder dry for a little while. Ian only led the first 10 laps of the restarted race, but never lost the following pack. We had Espargaró, we had Marquez, Rabat. Marquez did drop down to fifth at one point. Callio worked his way up to catch them. But Ian only eventually got caught, and it did look like he'd done his tyres. He was starting to struggle. I mean, he's got such a dramatic style, and it's great to watch. But, yeah, I mean, he was backing it in. It just seems to be everyone in Moto2 likes to do it.
But, I mean, even when Marquez fell down to fifth, you still had pretty much the idea, the personal assumption that it was just a waiting game.
Yeah.
That he was going to come back, and he was just trying to figure out, it was almost, let's go back and do some reconnaissance and figure out what these boys are going to have for me for the end of the race, and very particularly Iannone. And he probably went back and he said, okay, that's what I've got to contend with. I need to do that with him. And it was certain, to me at least, that he was going to be able to come back and finish it off the way that he did.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was. We had Espargaró and Marquez pulled away from Iannone, who was in a safe third. Mika Callio, I think, was 5-odd seconds behind him in a little group with Rabat and Agata. And Callio won that to get fourth. But what was really going on was, and I compared this to Catalunya 09, the Rossi and Lorenzo last lap. We had 5 leader changes on that last lap with some really aggressive but fantastically thought through and just brilliant passes by both Pol Espargaró and Marc Marquez. Some people squealed that Marquez had stuck his leg out, and that's, you know, oh, that's not fair. And it's like, well, it's his leg, it's attached to him, it's where he is. He's not, you know, it wasn't a block pass in the sense of a blocking someone by taking their racing line. He was in the lead, and but Jules has made some good points here, just saying that was the very last corner where Marquez did that. And Jules writes, it was the corner before that, the last tight right-hander, T14, called Caro, that won the race. When I first saw it, I was filled with rage at Marc Marquez 93, because it looked like a block pass. But when I saw the replay, I saw the genius in what he did, and it was totally clean. And basically, Marquez got in the inside and inevitably was running wide, but managed to do it and basically force Espargaró with him, which is, you know, it's a valid move that we've seen hundreds of times.
Right. And he didn't take him off course.
No. Yeah. Espargaró had been much braver through turn 12 and turn 13, biggest balls corners. And he went into turn 14, set for a much better acceleration line, which would have won in the race. However, Marquez made a brilliant move because he was on the inside. He was able to control the speed of both riders, and he kept the corner slow much longer than normal, taking away Pol's better line. And because he was on the inside of the corner, he came out a bike length ahead. The next corner with a leg out didn't matter. And I made this point. I don't think that Pol was close enough to have taken him anyway. But it was fantastic. Just ding dong. You know, I'm going to have you. Yeah, I'm going to have you back.
It was funny because for that entire race, my live feed had been working perfectly, and 3 corners from the end, it stopped.
Oh, joking?
No, I'm not.
That's interesting you say that, because there was a very, on Eurosport, it was a very brief where it goes all blocky and pixelated, but it was only for a second or so, because I just went no. And then it jumped back. So maybe you got the full.
I did. I got the full thing. But I still had audio. And right. So I did a quick reload, and then it shifted me back like 45 seconds So I got to watch the whole thing, quote unquote, live again, and then got to see the replay.
Yeah.
And before we watched the MotoGP race, I actually shut everything down and fired it back up again so that, because Jules and I were chatting back and forth with each other during the races. And I'm like, I need to get coordinated with you. So we were only about 2 seconds off once I got things back on again. But at a certain point, and this is funny, and people don't actually know this. And I'll let you make your point about Tom Luthi in a second. But it's funny about the MotoGP.com feed is that it really kind of depends upon where you land in the queue, where you get it. Because you can be anywhere from 10 seconds down on real time to I've seen up to 2 minutes. And so talking with somebody else about it, it's kind of dangerous if you're doing it over text or something else, because they may be a half a lap ahead of you.
Yeah.
The one time, Martin, we tried one time to do a live call during a race. Yeah, during a race, and it was the most pathetic, pitiful thing because, and we did it very quite globally. We had people in Australia and people all over the place, and we basically kind of gave up in laughter a good third of the way through because everybody was at a different point of the race. Anyway,
well, on Tom Luthi's, Jules and I had in the notes in the little comments you can put down the side. I just said, you know what's happened to Tom Luthi, who looked like he was going to be a sensible or a realistic title challenger earlier in the season. Right. Jules said lack of wins. I said, not just that, lack of pace. He's nowhere at the moment in terms of competing at the front. And Jules says, yeah, good point. I think the battle between Paul and Mark has brought the best out of both of them, whereas Tom, being Swiss, doesn't have a soul.
Oh, dear. Yeah, so look what we're looking at, the standings, and it kind of...
It's done barring Mark Marquez bouncing up the road on his head like he did last year.
I mean, Malaysia is still ahead of us.
It's 53 points in the lead.
We do have to remember this, though, is there's still quite a few races left in the season. It is an 18 race season, and everybody kind of likes to think when you get, you know, near 50 points that it's done and dusted. People are even saying the same thing about MotoGP, where Jorge is only 38 ahead. 38 or 46?
Yeah.
And there's a lot to go. Well, we've got 5 races left to go.
Yeah.
That's
125 points. Yeah. So absolutely.
So let me run down this real quick. I'll run down the top 5 and we can talk about some of the other folks. Marquez with 238, Paul Espargaró at 185, which is the gap we were just talking about. Iannone with 165, which that gap to the front, certainly up to Marquez, would be quite a tall leap. Luthi with 161 and Redding, which is pretty much is mathematically out of it at 115. Kallio, Smith, Rabat, Agüero, and so forth.
But that's interesting. Scott Redding does get a lot of attention, and yet his teammate Mika Kallio, who's hardly ever mentioned other than just, you know, during commentary in the races, is only 5 points behind him.
Yeah, well, he gets more mentioned for his ice racing skills than he does for his road racing skills.
Yeah, just going back to that race, that last lap, and I have to say, Julian Ryder made a brilliant comment about Marquez, and he said that's the sign of a true champion. Even though second place would be absolutely fine, he won't even give 5 points away. And it again reminded me of the Birth of the Legend race at Estoril in 2010. Yeah, 2010, where he was going to be the 125 champion. We knew that, you know, and his team were putting out a thing saying second, fine. You know, second is good. And he was like, no, I'm going to win. I'm absolutely going to win. So love him or hate him. And a lot of people seem to have a bit of a downer on Mark and think he's had, you know, unfair advantages or whatever. No, that kid is blindingly good.
Think of it in the terms of the way that I think of it, Martin. With 5 races to go and all those points available, I can certainly see where you wouldn't want to give up 5 points. The game isn't done yet, and we've seen stranger things happen. We certainly saw it last year. This is not a time to rest on your laurels. You still have to push as hard as you can.
Yeah, absolutely.
And besides, I mean, particularly after what happened last year for Marquez.
Yeah, and if he does bounce down the road on his head but still wins the championship by 4 points, then he'll say, yep, well, that was worth taking that win.
Exactly. So this dance is not done.
Nope.
GP.
Yeah. And it was dramatic, but not in the same way that Moto3 and Moto2 were. Again, we had this, most of the top riders didn't go out at all on the Friday. On a Saturday, we managed to get a damp FP3 drying, and then we did have QP, which was dry. And again, it was quite dramatic. Cal Crutchlow was on pole with 2 or 3 minutes to go, but as we know from the past, that doesn't mean anything. And Lorenzo then took pole back from him, and then Danny pipped him on his very last lap, but by 18 thousandths of a second. Then we had warm-up on the Sunday morning, and Danny was quickest by 10 thousandths of a second. So we had these two lads, Lorenzo and Pedrosa, looking absolutely, this was going to be hammer and tongs. And then there was the start problem. And basically what happened was, Carol Abraham, just as the lights came on, and he put his hand up.
Whoa. Let's back it up a little bit. I think this is extremely important to talk about, because there were things that were going on before that, before the start, that actually pointed, that provide some clues as to what happened on the start itself. On the first warm up, and this is key, and this is goes back to what we were talking about before about the faulty parts for Ducati, when Abraham's clutch was grabbing, and so as soon as he would let the clutch out, the bike would stall. And that's what happened when they took the bike out for one lap. They came back as soon as he did went to do his warm up lap, but a very similar thing, although certainly not mechanical. We don't know the reason for it yet. Both he and Pedrosa had to get pushed off for their warm-up lap.
Yeah.
That is really key as to what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So they did that, right? Then they came back, and then we had the kerfuffle, right? That kind of screwed everything up. And then when they had their second warm-up lap.
Yeah, I mean, the kerfuffle being that Carol Abraham put his arm up, yeah, and on the lights, and I'd never seen this before, they started flashing amber lights, and no one really knew what was happening. The red lights went out, a couple of people jumped forward and then stopped. Most of them got the message. No one went shooting off thinking the race had started. And obviously, we then had a problem, and Carol Abraham had to swap bikes, and the other one had a problem, and it was bloody disaster.
But at the same time,
we had this problem with Danny Pedrosa's bike.
Right, which was a complete disaster for him. I'm wondering how we should explain this, because maybe what we should do is let's drop down to Jules' notes, because he actually got word from race control, which I think is most important. I don't want to necessarily run through the rules. Let me do it just very briefly. There is a section that actually points this specifically. It's section 1.18.1. Only riders who have completed at least one sighting lap will be permitted to start the race from their position published on the final grid. Under no circumstances may they push onto the grid from the pit lane. That's a key thing right there. That's why you had to start from the back.
Yeah.
1 minute before the start of the warm-up lap, display of 1 minute board on the grid. Tire warmers must be removed from machines on the grid. That's also extremely key. At this point, all team personnel, except for the mechanics, will leave the grid. The mechanics will, as quickly as possible, assist the rider to start the machine and will then vacate the grid. It goes on and on and on. There's another part that's very key too, because this is something that is easy to forget. The rule book is long and complicated, and not all the guys, kind of remember it. So this is section 1.18.18. And you guys out there in Motopod land, I know you like technicalities. Well, we're getting deep into it here, but this is something everybody's been talking about all week. 1.18.18 says, Should there be a problem that might prejudice safety, then the starter will display a flashing yellow light and the board start delayed, and a marshal will wave a yellow flag at each row of the starting grid from the signaling platform. Martin, we saw that happen.
Yeah.
The start procedure will be recommenced at the 1 minute board stage. The riders will complete an additional warm-up lap, also key, and the race distance will be reduced by one lap. And that's also exactly what happened. And so that's the rub. You know, it's there's no time set before the 1 minute board. It's all up to, you know, what goes on. Now, I'm not going to walk through the entire thing, even though if Jules wants to do it again later, it's fine. He breaks it down to an extremely granular thing. But I do want to talk about some other parts here. And then we'll talk also briefly about, because Jules got in touch with Mike Webb, who is the race director, and gave us some direct feedback. Written in Autosport, FIM president Vito Ippolito criticized Misano's race directors following the chaotic start procedure that contributed to Danny Pedrosa's early exit from the San Marino Grand Prix. The most damning point, Ippolito points out, at this point, everyone was taken by surprise and the biggest mistake was made. The track was open and the starting procedure got reactivated, thus allowing many people to get close to the bikes and riders. Instead, only the mechanics with the starters were supposed to be allowed to enter, and then the start would be given. Those are the guys that actually, when you see the gates open and let people out, they're the ones that let people in and out. Well, I've always seen those being Dorna people. So that's me. I don't know. Those always seem like high-ranking Dorna people, because I know that for the fact that they've stopped me in the past from walking out of the grid.
Yeah.
And so... there was a communications issue. I mean, it's really hard to, it's the old telephone game, you know, one person says something, because not everybody's all on the same radios. There's a whole bunch of networks that go on. People have to pass something to somebody else and pass something to somebody else. There's no way you could hear everything. I've been on, I spent time doing corner captaining as a marshal, and you hear one section, everything that's going on course. But if you heard everything that was going at race direction, it'd drive your mind crazy. So anyway, that was the first time that these riders have seen that flashing yellow light and start delayed sign. So almost nobody in teams knows how to react. And so let me quote Mike Webb, because Jules, as I said, wrote into him and asked him about it. And very cool of him, the race director for Dorna, wrote back to us saying, "The rule says the restart procedure is taken from the 1 minute board, but there is deliberately no set period between the incident and that restart procedure. This is because the incident that caused the delayed start can be anything, an oil leak on track, bike falling over, stalled bike, and each takes a different amount of time to handle. It's my call when the restart procedure commences, and I do that when I see it is safe to do so. For example, all teams are informed and ready. Since the riders don't know immediately how long before the restart, they stop the engines, which inevitably means mechanics are necessary to restart them, and naturally they take tire warmers with them. I say they don't know immediately. However, very soon after the incident, I am telling the grid staff when the 1 minute board will be shown, and they are informing the teams to be ready." He goes on, and as I mentioned, this is the first time these riders have seen a flashing yellow light and start delayed signs, so almost nobody in the teams knows exactly how to react. This was very clear in Misano. Most had probably never read Article 1.18.8, or at least had forgotten it. So it's been a learning experience for us all, and even though the rules were followed in Misano, I can see where they can be improved, and we'll be meeting in Aragon to solve this. The most important thing after that is communication to the teams to make sure everyone understands exactly what to do in that situation.
And I think it's also worth making the point on Danny's bike that they were saying the wheel was locked by a tire warmer being jammed. And Steve Parrish was saying, no, that wouldn't happen. He said, the tire warmer won't come out because the wheel is locked, but the wheel was locked for another reason.
Yep.
And it rather sounds like he had a hydraulic seizure, a brake lockage.
But at the same time, I think it was Jules that pointed out that under certain circumstances, you can end up with a tire warmer melted to a carbon disc, and yeah, you basically have it. Yeah. I mean, those things are blazingly hot, obviously.
So they pushed it in, then they pushed it out, and in the movement, they believe a mechanic activated the pit lane speed limiter, yep, which is why when they went for the final warm-up lap to then take their place on the grid, Danny was pooping on.
And on the final warm-up lap, again, both Abraham and Danny
needed push starting.
Needed push starting.
Which was not a good sign. And he got overtaken by the safety car. So when he came round, but what was interesting was Danny was either communicated with or knew, because he lined straight up at the back. It's not like he went to pole position and got moved back. He went straight to the back of the grid, which confused certainly the BBC and I, to a degree, I think, Messrs. Moody and Ryder at first.
Yep.
And I think it was Julian Ryder then pinged and said, the safety car got past him. If you're behind the safety car, you go to the back of the grid.
Yeah,
he'd retaken, he'd overtaken the safety car once he sorted out it was the pit lane button. So, you can't blame Danny for that. It was just a series of cock-ups, which meant he was at the back of the grid.
Talk about fucking with your mind.
Yeah, exactly. Now, before we go to the, I just do want to mention QP, Johnny Ray, his first time in anger on this bike, qualified ninth, ahead of Nicky Hayden, Carol Abraham and Hector Barbara, who are also on factory / satellite prototypes, and in front of all the CRTs. So damn good effort by Johnny Ray, who hasn't been that bike once, which is pretty bloody good, considering he's very new to it. Anyway, we lined
up. You just jinxed him.
Yeah. We lined up with a gap where pole position should have been. So the front row was Lorenzo and Crutchlow, and then Bradle, Bautista, Rossi, and so on, so forth backwards. So Rossi had a good qualifying. He had a brilliant start. But Lorenzo got out front, and as far as the lead went, that was it. He ran the race at the front, controlling it. He never got a huge amount away. What was interesting was what was going on behind, because for the first few laps, we had Rossi with Stefan Bradle, who'd gone around the outside of Cal Crutchlow to take third place in one of the early corners, absolutely nailed to him. And it looked like he was holding Bradle up. Behind Bradle, we had the Tech to Our points train of Dovizioso and Cal Crutchlow. Behind them was Ben Spies and Alvaro Bautista. Nicky Hayden, riding with an injury, was had a pretty lonely race. And behind him, Johnny Ray was slowly closing in on him, but never actually got that too close. He got within 2 seconds, but then he'd have a moment, drop back. But Rossi just held off Bradle, and then Stefan Bradle started to fade. Cal Crutchlow crashed out, which was a great shame.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it looked like he was certainly on the podium.
Yeah, he was certainly had the pace for it. Well, he had up to then in the weekend, and he was very bullish about his chances. People have Rossi looked very, very accomplished. It did not look like this was his first dry podium, because he managed to bring it home in second place. And Alvaro Bautista very calmly and competently worked his way past the guys ahead of him. He went past, I'm trying to think if he went past Crutchlow, if Crutchlow crashed, therefore promoting him.
Yeah, he got promoted by Crutchlow, but I mean, he was creeping up on him. Yep.
But he'd gone past Ben, he went past Dovi, and he went past Bradle, and he was chasing down Rossi, but he never, again, he was just inside 2 seconds at the end. But
that was the first race this season or last season where Rossi, to me, looked to be challenging and looked completely comfortable on the bike. I mean, absolutely. I didn't see. We have to look back a few years to the Rossi of old to see somebody that looked like he could hold a fast pace and not make mistakes. It seemed like he was hitting his marks all the way around the tracks. I don't remember a bobble out of him. Do you?
No. It looked smooth. It looked competent. He seemed to be. And again, when you looked at his face, he wasn't looking up and around as he's been photographed, and he was back to that weird looking down at the front wheel as he went through a corner. And it was very much a renaissance race for him. But Bautista had brought Dovi with him, and those two, Dovi put in a cracking pass to try and get third place. Bautista popped back inside him, and it was basically a power run from the last corner, and Dovi lost out by 0.003 of a second. And Alvaro Bautista got his first MotoGP podium on the Gresini bike at the Circuit di Marco Simoncelli. I mean, it was just an incredibly emotional and pretty wonderful result. And as someone pointed out, on the podium you had Marco's bike ridden by Bautista, or the bike that he had ridden and that his team, and his best mate in Valentino Rossi. So it was very fitting.
There was, you know, obviously with the circuit being named for Simoncelli, there was an awful lot of pre-race stuff that was going on.
Yeah, all the riders had cycled around the circuit on the Thursday, and Matt Roberts had ridden from London or from UK all the way there on a charity cycle thing. Kevin Schwantz had joined them, and that was a heck of a journey.
They also, I do want to point out, although it was a small ceremony, they did a bit for Tomazawa there. The whole Tech 3 team, very, very obviously very early or late, or early in the morning or late in the evening, gathered and laid flowers at the corner where he passed a few years back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And his parents were there. Tomazawa's parents were there, which was nice. So what it does to the title, and we'll go on to a couple of wash-up points in a moment, but that does leave Lorenzo on 270 points, 38 clear of Dani Pedrosa on 232, and that is realistically the only two. I mean, Stoner's back on 186. Dovi is on 163, so he's only 23 points behind Casey. That's achievable, that gap. Big gap, 41 points back to Cal Crutchlow on 122, with Rossi on 120. I mean, he could still get fifth in the championship, but then only 2 points behind him is Bautista, who's 3 points ahead Bradl. So you've got a really tight group there. Fifth through eighth, separated by only 7 points.
Nobody notices that.
we don't, but I suspect the teams do. And I think they'll look at that and say,
Well, it's important, but I mean, that being said, everybody's signed at this point. I mean, it's a point of pride for sure. Nobody's, with the exception of Bautista, kind of fighting for a ride at this point.
No, but I think, I mean, if I was sixth, I'd think I'd want to come fifth. If I was fifth, I'd want to come fourth. immediately in the aftermath, there was a bunch of stuff on Twitter. Mainly, I don't know why, and I know it's a theme I've harped on before, particularly the Rossi fans seem to want to remove any credibility from anything Lorenzo does. And I think it's because they feel threatened and they're worried about... No, I seriously do. I seriously think if you look back in 2009, Lorenzo and Rossi were almost perfectly matched, with Rossi had the edge. In 2010, they were almost perfectly matched. Lorenzo had the edge, and this is before Rossi's injury. He'd been showing an advantage. He's only got better. Rossi's had a couple of terrible years, and he's 2 years older. Okay, so's Lorenzo, but he's still approaching his prime rather than possibly past it. I think they're worried about next year, and there's no doubt Rossi will challenge for wins. I just don't think he will consistently. But that's, anyway, that's by the by. One thing that was... which wound me up, and I responded to John Hart, yanked my chain very effectively on the Facebook fan page and said, you know, well, Lorenzo's been handed it with that crash.
I had to drag your ass.
Well,
back
you did. And I went back in with some gusto. And I had one word to respond to that, was assen. So Danny's had one inadvertent DNF, so's Jorge. So I just had a quick look at the stats. And if anybody doubts the validity of Jorge's position at the top of the championship, so far this season, 13 races, Jorge, 6 wins, 6 second places, 1 DNF, not his fault. Danny, 3 wins, 3 seconds, 4 thirds, 1 fourth, 1 DNF, not his fault. Casey, 4 wins, 1 second, 2 thirds, 2 fourths, 1 eighth, and he hasn't completed in 2 races due to the injury, and that will probably be more than that by the end of the season. He's not going to Aragon, certainly. And one of the fourths was at Indy when he was injured. However, you know, QED, Jorge is the deserved leader of the pack. Jules' rebuttal is, this is all fine and dandy, and I totally agree with it. Jorge's been incredible, but I can't even imagine the rant Martin would be on about if it was Jorge that got screwed by the start instead of Danny. I don't think I'd have ranted. I think I'd have been... I'd have been disappointed. But you know, I didn't rant about Bautista wiping him out. I just said it was a damn shame that, you know, a title contender gets you know, dumped out by somebody else. And let's not forget that it was Casey's eighth was at the Saxon Ring where he crashed. But that was of his own making. So it's you know, I am publicly acknowledged as a Jorge Lorenzo fan, but I like to think this is pretty objective. And if that was Jorge in second and anyone else in first, I would still be highlighting the fact that, hang on, 6 wins, 6 seconds, and 1 inadvertent DNF. That is the best ride of the season so far. It doesn't matter who it is.
It is true. And but then again, it is so far.
Yeah.
One of the things that, while you were running through there that I was pondering was if, depending upon how Rossi finishes out the season, and certainly as we both mentioned that it was great to see a bit of a turnaround, regardless of what he does, and we obviously know he's going to Yamaha for the next 2 years. 2 years? Yeah, it's a 2-year contract. Whatever happens at Yamaha, there's been a part of me that sort of wants to see him, you know, finish that out, depending upon how long he stays. Retire, go drive cars or something like that, and then come back like 2 years later on the redesigned, now semi-competitive or competitive Ducati, and come back and do a Bayless, win a race, final race of the year at Valencia, just walk away with it.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. I'd still love to see him go to World Superbike. Although I do think if that happened anytime soon, that could have serious repercussions for MotoGP, as far as viewings goes.
I don't think it'll happen.
I don't think it will, but
With a 2-year contract at Yamaha, I think at that point he's probably gonna you know, retire to a beater.
Having said that,
or
he'll only
like
be what, 35, and he'll look at what Bayliss and Checa and Biaggi have been able to do into their 40s and go, I don't know. We don't know. But Rossi was back on the podium. It was the first time in the dry with Ducati. Mixed reactions from the Rossi fanieri going, oh my God, he's back, to the Rossi knockers going, yeah, well, Stoner Pedrosa weren't in it. Crutchlow would have probably beaten him, and he's tested a bunch at Misano. And to the more balanced, and I think this is, you know, probably the right balance to take, or the right view to take, is yes, testing will have helped, but they've definitely made steps in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt.
The other things I noticed, I think Stefan Bradl, it was another creditable finish in six, but he was probably disappointed by that. But he has had a sterling year, and it will be interesting to see where HRC's focus, which I think traditionally has been more Grassini, have been closer to the HRC spec than LCR. And I think Honda like Stefan Bradl, and I think they like LCR and what they're able to do as a team. And I wonder if that they might be a little bit more on an even playing field for next year, whoever does get that Grassini ride.
Yeah. Whatever happens with Grassini and LCR next year is going to be very interesting. We don't have any information on that yet. And news, clues, and rumors as to really what's going to happen there as far as factory support. But there's no doubt that one of those teams is going to see it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and although Grassini's been closer, they have been using them as a bit of a test bed this year, with Bautista running Showa suspension rather than Olin's, and, you know.
But they did switch shocks for this race.
Yes.
Or five forks for this race. So that may have been a pretty big jump. And on top of that, we still don't know, and I still speculate, and there are some people that poo-poo it, but we really don't know what was under the covers of either the Grassini bike or the LCR bike with Jonathan Rea
running for that, you know, in a backup routine for that team, whether he was actually on Casey's bike or had Casey's motors.
You banged on about this LCR having the factory spec, and I don't know where you got that from, but I didn't hear it anywhere but from you, Jim. So
I did an interview at Indy with Lucio.
I like to think it didn't happen because Stefan looked as good as he has all season, but no better. So, anyway. Right, sir, I think we can probably wrap it up there with a look forward to World Superbike at Portimao this weekend. Fantastic racetrack. Please get MotoGP there sometime.
That would be nice, but please get me there sometime. There's a pretty cool article that you guys should check out that we'll link to about a interview that David Emmett did with Ben Spies. I think it was a group interview, but about doping. That started off with a conversation about Lance Armstrong, because Ben is very much into cycling, but then kind of got into potential doping in MotoGP.
Yeah, I've heard it, and it's very interesting.
Yeah, a link to that in the show notes. I think that may be it. A lot of talk this week. Again, Portimao, as you mentioned, Martin, will be coming up this weekend. A fantastic track. Hopefully, they'll get some dry weather, although I would kind of like to see a wet race there. Just out of curiosity, because we haven't. In the meantime, thank you so much for downloading the show. My name is Jim Race. I've got Martin Darlington here. It's cool to have you guys listen to us. It was great to get some a donation this week. And with the folks that we have heading out to the races, if you can help out there, it would be massively appreciated. You can do so through the Facebook fan page at facebook.com/motopod or through our website at www.motopodcast.com. You can also write in to us if you want to hear us talk about stuff that you guys want to hear about at motopod@motopodcast.com. And with that, Martin, I think we should wrap this thing up.
I think we're done.
Yep, and it's time for you to go off and fly around and pick up the
knuckleheads. I'm on a day off today, so I'm going to go for a bit of a walk, but I'm just going to dive out and say ta-ra to the little one who's off to high school. Yeah, she started high school 2 weeks ago, so.
Holy cow.
Don't adjust, yes.
All right, then you can. All right. Well, tell them both, Mia and Sharon, that Motopod staff says hello. And ladies and gentlemen, we will talk to you next week after Portimao runs.
Cheers, everyone.
All right. Cheers.
Shut up.
Good night.